Under the Radar to me means authenticity, not being filtered.
It's a window in on the local stories that touch our lives.
And there's a huge void in the traditional media covering this new faces of Boston.
You may not be looking for a particular story, but when you hear about it, you're engaged.
Under the Radar means ahead of the curve.
It's also perspectives. How does this particular story affect a community or a neighborhood?
I'm Callie Crossley. This week, Under the Radar, all things art. Imaginative as well as risque theater adaptations of Chekhov and Shakespeare. A Newton native goes undercover to gather material for a provocatively themed play. And some of jazz's greats jamming at a no-frills Cambridge hotspot. In this special Under the Radar, we're talking about the local art scene you may not know about. Later in the show, actress, dancer, choreographer, and TV director-producer Debbie Allen. Well known for her role in the TV show Fame, Debbie Allen is in Boston to give some talented young artists a shot on the musical stage. I'll also talk to her about her career and her take on the 21st century art scene. But first, joining me in the studio is Alicia Anstead, editor of Inside Arts Magazine and the Harvard Arts Blog, and editor-in-chief of The Writer Magazine. Welcome back, Alicia.
Hi, Callie.
Joel Brown, contributor for the Boston Globe, writing the Stages column about local theater. His blog is hubarts.com. Hi, Joel.
Hi, Callie.
And Susanna Jackson, arts and entertainment editor for Dig Boston. Hello, Susanna.
Hi, Callie.
Okay, well, let's jump right in. I am really taken with these imaginative theater adaptations. Joel, the one that you mentioned is just so fun for me, from the theater in Chelsea, taking off on The Seagull. As we know, The Seagull...
Yes, I don't think we can say the title here.
No, we will not be saying the entire title here. It's risque. But The Seagull, the Chekhov Seagull, is actually playing across town on the radar.
Right.
And this is the Under the Radar take.
Well, yeah, that's... That's what I really wanted to talk about here is go across the water to see some theater. There's a lot of the cities, not a lot, but some of the best theater and small theaters in town is over in Charlestown, and Whistler and the Dark Theater Company is doing Carol Churchill's Far Away starting this week, and it's their last production. They've been around for nine years.
Oh, my goodness.
One of the things about French theater is companies sort of come and go. But I think we're in a real renaissance of kind of small company theater here in Boston. There are more than 40 groups doing shows around now, so there's a lot of good stuff to see.
Let me stop you and ask you, how do you define fringe theater when you say fringe theater?
They have day jobs is probably the easiest way to do it. You know, these are not equity houses. These are not places that have big production budgets. Shoestring theater, usually in a rented space, sometimes not even in a typical theater. But they're actually one of the reasons the Fringe is really coming up in Boston is there are some spaces for them now. The new building at the Boston Center for the Arts, there's now like four or five or six spaces there they can use. There's the Factory Theater. There's a couple of places in Cambridge. I mean, they have venues now that didn't really exist 10 years ago.
And so the aforementioned, is it Apollinaire Theater in Chelsea?
Apollinaire,
okay. Theater in Chelsea. They're doing, as I say, the take on The Seagull called Stupid Blank Bird.
Yes. they have a really neat, it used to be the Odd Fellows Hall right in downtown Chelsea there. And I think the last time I was over there for Uncle Vanya, and they did it on all three floors of this 1900, sort of broken down 1900 building. They're very imaginative. Deborah Jacques is very, very good director, and she kind of runs the place. But they really try some different things there. They've also done theater. They did Cyrano a couple of years ago that I reviewed for the Globe, and it sounds lovely and pastoral. It was outdoors, ... in the shadow of the Tobin Bridge. You know, so they really try some interesting things over there, and I think this will be a fun show, especially if you can manage to see this and The Seagull.
All right. That's my guest, Joel Brown, whose blog is hubarts.com. And we're talking about, in this instance, just these interesting adaptations of theater under the radar. I should mention in this moment that we have an embarrassment of riches here at WGBH. So our on the radar reporter is Jared Bowen, who has covered The Seagull at the Huntington, the real one, the straight take of Chekhov. People can find his reports at Open Studio with Jared Bowen and also on Greater Boston. Now, over to you, Alicia, because you note that the theater adaptations that we're going to focus on now, the one over at Suffolk on Midsummer Night's Dream, is actually part of a piece of a lot of work being coming to a conclusion now at the end of the semester for students.
Right. This is a really hot time in the college scene, particularly around Boston, where there are so many terrific theater departments, including Suffolk University, where Marilyn Plotkins, the chair of the theater department there, is putting on a production called Midsummer Night, which is a rock festival musical which reimagines a Midsummer Night's Dream, as you said, by Shakespeare. What I love about this is it's a new work. It started in 2006 in Princeton under the directorship of Tina Landau, one of the great American directors, and now has been reimagined as a 90-minute piece that Marilyn describes. The big word that jumped out of me was joyful. It's written for 11 characters, roles, and when you're talking about college theater at the end of a year, at the end of the semester, you're talking about we need lots of roles. So she's inflated it to 21 roles and add another 20 or 25 creative team students plus two alums. And you've got energy, I'm sure, blasting off the stage. One year, I went to three productions at three colleges of the same show, Into the Woods by Stephen Sondheim. And one was at Harvard, one was at Emerson, one was at Suffolk. And I went to them within 2 days of each of their showings. And I have to say, college theater is where joy and energy take place. You know, that's where experimentation happens. People, you know, they're still learning how to do what they do, so they give their all. The passion is there. The talent is there. This show I'm very interested in because it's such a pumped-up version. It's by a husband and wife duo named Valerie Vigoda and Brendan Milburn, who have some pretty serious musical theater creds out there, and they've been involved in the production. Valerie Vigoda just did a two-day workshop with the kids at Suffolk, and I think this one's going to bounce right off the stage.
Oh, wow. And so in the next few weeks, we're going to see a lot of these end-of-the-semester college productions.
I'd say check those college calendars because, you know, often these are free productions. Sometimes they're for very minimal cost, $5. Sometimes they're covering shows that you want to take the kids to, like Carousel at Emerson in April. You know, so it's an easy, inexpensive, and extremely supportive way to be with the next generation of artists, some of whom, especially in these universities in Boston, go on to have pretty prestigious careers.
Yeah, I would say. I'm thinking about the Fugitive Man, Tommy, the actor.
Tommy Lee Jones.
Tommy Lee Jones.
Thank you. He was at Harvard.
A lot of them just graduate and start those fringe companies
we were talking about,
too.
So it's all connected there. So I was thinking the folks in the college productions end up in the fringe companies. So we got a lot to say there, to talk about there. All right, moving over to you, Suzanne. And by the way, that was my guest, Alicia Anstead of Inside Arts Magazine, Harvard Arts Blog, and The Writer Magazine. Susanna of Dig Boston, you brought to our attention really what we'd call undercover reporting. Yeah, in my business.
Yes, this is art as activism.
Yes.
Or activism as art.
So tell us about it.
This is a one-woman show by Madeline Burroughs, who's actually a Newton native. For a college course, she was inspired to do some undercover research with the Students for Life Convention and other pro-life, anti-abortion movements. And that inspired, you know, after her experiences and seeing kind of the force that they have, as what she would say is stripping away women's rights, she decided that she wanted to do more with the project besides the college course and turned it into a one-woman show. She actually went back to school, met a great creative team, and now she's touring with it, bringing it back to Boston at Davis Square Theater. It's controversial. You know, the head of the Students for Life organization retaliated in a National Review article, basically calling it crass and uninformed, which it's anything but uninformed.
That's the group that she infiltrated or went undercover with.
She went to the Students for Life National Convention, and she kind of satirizes that. And also, it's important to note that it's not aimed to convert anyone's beliefs. It's kind of if you are a pro-choice advocate, then this is kind of trying to get you to take the next step. Our rights are being trampled, and she wants to show that the opposing force isn't backing down. And if we don't do something about it, and I say we because I'm on that side, then we'll lose our rights. And so this one-woman show is kind of trying to, drum up some conversation. And she's just she's a great actress. She's a great person.
I was taken a little bit by what I thought came out of it and what she was saying, despite her fundamental differences with Students for Life, which is the group that she infiltrated, that there was an energy there and a passion, which she was saying to the people that she feels is her side, hey,
we don't
pay
have
attention.
This.
You don't have this. These people have passion and energy about it. Yeah,
I think that she would argue that some of it's a little, over the top. It's kind of like cult-like, from what I gather. But yes, she's they're inspired and they're driven, and we don't have that kind of force or that energy on the left side. And she wants that to happen.
Okay. All right. So moving on to this is a not something going on, but something that's happening, really. This is an ongoing issue in the theater, as I've a little bit that I know. Joel, you wrote a piece for The Globe about the diversity gap in theaters around the area. But what you were jumping off of was this conversation in Washington called The Summit, which was pulled together by Peter Marks, the Washington Post's theater critic, and it was storified. A lot of the tweets that came out of that, and people have had various levels of response to it, most of it anger. A lot of women.
A lot of anger.
A lot of anger from a couple of comments. One by a theater director, Ryan Rillette, who said, which seemed to me something that is obvious, the women in the pipeline, the people of color in the pipeline are few. And when he means pipeline in that discussion, it's not pipeline as we think of it, generally speaking, though it could be applied in this case. But he was specifically talking about New York, London. And in that way, these are the centers of theater, and this is where people go to pick the plays that get produced. And then, of course, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy about who produces those plays, who directs those plays, who writes those plays, et cetera, et cetera. But you tapped into something here with a guy in Boston.
Yes, Patrick Gabridge, who's a playwright here in the city and who is... As he says, he's a white guy. Diversity isn't affecting him, but as he says, he's married to a woman. He has a couple of African American children, and he's keenly interested in this issue. So after the summit, he went and did the numbers. Full time writer. He's got a few hours at home. He looked at, I think it was 48 theater companies the current season here in Boston, and came up with some numbers that a lot of people, nobody is really surprised by them, but nobody's particularly happy about them either. I went to the census data. Women are actually 52% of the population here in Boston, but they're writing and directing about 40% of the plays. And the numbers are even worse for African Americans and Latinos, significantly lower participation in those parts of theater than they are in the population. This wasn't an action plan by him, but there is some action happening, or at least talk happening, which is another issue. A lot of people are kind of tired of talking about this, they told me, but... The Stage Source is having a big town hall meeting on April 26th at Boston Playwrights Theater to talk specifically about the gender issue. And that whole pipeline comment, I think the reason it inflamed so many people, when he said there weren't plays by women and African Americans in the pipeline, well, maybe not his pipeline. A lot of people felt there's plenty of writers out there and plenty of plays. Why aren't more of them being produced?
Oh, no. He was clear. He defined his pipeline as New York, London. And then that made a big statement about the narrowness of what the pipeline is. As a fact, his Roundhouse Theater apparently is one that has women directors and women plays and blah, blah, blah. So he's not unfamiliar with what's going on, but that's what he meant. But we can, around this table, know that when you say pipeline, it's even a bigger issue than that. Alicia, you want to weigh in on that? And why does this matter for people who are listening in the arts world? Why is it important that what was being said here and what Joel's piece shows yet again with this time some documentation.
Right. So I think when anyone says diversity doesn't affect me as a white person or whatever your role is, that's a lack of awareness about the diversity of voices and the richness that comes with that in our national discussion. For the last 2 years, I've participated in the Sphinx Con Diversity in the Performing Arts Conference in Detroit. And Aaron Dworkin, the founder of Sphinx Organization, which targets Black and Latino classical music players only, and advocates and advances their careers in education, he's looking at this from a national point of view in the performing arts. And the range of discussions at those conferences remind me of discussions that probably took place in the 1960s, but also are taking place now in a new format. That whole range from that early discussion all the way through to people who are saying, we don't really need to talk about this anymore. We need to act. And that's the major message coming out of that conference each year. Time to act, time to act, time to step up and make sure that you have those directors in your theaters, advocate for people to get into your audiences, put work on stage that has that point of view that's not necessarily mainstream.
And that's reflective of a lot of, as we would say, lived experiences from different folks. I want to point out that there is something, another thing that grew out of that format for summit discussion in D.C. This woman, Elaine Romero, started a list called We Exist, which is an open source list. And anybody can go and add, you know, names of women. And she specifically is focusing on women and women, female-identified playwrights. But the list has gone longer and longer. And, of course, the overarching discussion is that the pipeline is not just New York and London. There are people everywhere in this country and around the world, for that matter, that we need to be talking about. So that's Elaine Romero. The list is We Exist. If you have names that you know about, anyone listening that wants to add to it, and that's a direct response to the summit conversation. Now, another response in a local way, Susanna, you wrote about a group called Sweeties, or an organization called Sweeties, or maybe it's a place, but tell us about it.
It's a space / platform started by a quartet of artists, and their goal is to provide a space in Boston, not outside of Boston, not Dorchester, not Worcester, which we're seeing a lot of young artists have to retreat to because they can't afford rent here, that focuses on young artists, contemporary artists, with a priority of artists of color. I haven't talked to them more tonight about a piece I'm doing later this week that will come out later this week. Their first show is True Love on Friday, and they're just a great group of artists who, you know, live this philosophy, and their work shows that. And the artists that are involved have a lot of other different projects going on. One of them is New Body. They're also a platform that brings artists of color speakers to events around Boston to talk people that wouldn't normally have the opportunity to find a stage. There was a recent one, Dark Matter, two gay activists who through their art are, you know, kind of calling out the, you know, patriarchy and, you know, they're just an interesting group of people.
And how do people find their way to them, or how do they find the people who perform there?
So they're very active in the Boston arts community. So they're reaching out specifically to people that they are moved by. You know, they're traveling, they're seeing all these people, and they're bringing them people that have moved them to larger audiences. I know that they're, you know, a few of them are fresh out of college, SMFA students. So people that they have been networking with or people that they're bringing to their space for their first show, at least.
SMFA?
Yes. School of Museum of Fine Arts.
Thank you.
No problem.
Those not in arts jargon. If you're just tuning in, this is our special arts edition of Under the Radar with Callie Crossley. I'm Callie Crossley, and with me is Alicia Anstead of Inside Arts Magazine, the Harvard Arts Blog, and the Writer Magazine, Joel Brown of the Hub Arts Blog, and Susanna Jackson, you just heard her, of Dig Boston. Moving on, I mean, the Sweeties space is really, where physically is it again?
It's in the South End, 59 Wareham Street.
All right, just want to make sure that I got that out. I want to point out that we're having this discussion at a time when the mayor of this town has taken a huge step toward spotlighting the importance of arts and culture in this city. He said it on the campaign. You know how sometimes people say it on the campaign and then it goes away. But now it's really happening. They're posting a job for the arts commissioner. And the way they've described what they want this arts czar to do is really quite it's really an emphasis on synthesizing a lot of what we're talked about here. So maybe in the future, it would be easier for people to understand some of the under-the-radar arts stuff that we're talking about here, along with some of the major theater houses and dance performances in town. Love to get your take on what you think the impact of an arts commissioner can have. Susanna?
Well, honestly, I'm not quite sure what that means for the under-the-radar and fringe theaters. the problem that we're currently having with, you know, if we look at Sweeties and the other small art galleries that don't have the funding and these artists that are leaving schools, We have a very, very vibrant art scene at the college level. We have plenty of theater students, art students, film students, and then after they graduate, they really don't have anywhere to go. These younger artists don't have the money to pay the rent, and, you know, we're pushing them out because we don't have the spaces for them to showcase their work. I think the importance of the art commissioner, or that's something that they should consider, is looking at these young artists, because these are going to be the backbone of Boston's art scene come in a few years. And if we don't support them right out of the gate, then we're not going to have that art community. And sure, you know, you're going to have these big productions. We love ART. We love Huntington. And, you know, these larger galleries, we have a very vibrant South End galleries. But these younger artists need support more than ever. And I think that our art commissioner, if that is something that's being talked about, then it can make a huge impact on our art scene.
Joel, before you respond to that, I just want to point out that there is also, he promised, and there is now a line item for a tax that would raise some money to support arts-related, arts-themed projects. Now, I don't know how it gets to the people that Susanna was talking about, but that's a step that I know a lot of the people in the arts community have been asking for, and it's supposed to happen.
I think that tax, I think hiring the art czar, I think those are both part of sort of a post-Menino change in attitude, things that people have been looking for and talking about for a long time. You will often hear people say, why don't we have a South by Southwest here in Boston? And I think the new mayor really sort of gets that idea, and you look at things like they've got the T restarting the late night service, which is those young people who are going to those fringe theaters. Late night tea service, increasing closing time on the bars, you know, things like that, just kind of a general change in attitude that it doesn't just have to be, let's go to that downtown theater and go home to the suburbs. I mean, the, creating sort of a vibrant scene downtown for the arts in general, I think, is something that he gets. We'll see how it works in practice, but I think it's a good start.
Alicia.
It's a voice at the table. Anytime you have a voice at the policy table, you have a watchdog, you have an advocate for the arts. Incredibly important in setting up the foundation for making sure that the arts are noticed and taken care of and advanced in the city. Mayor Walsh is committed to the arts. One of his chiefs, Joyce Linehan, has deep roots in the Boston art scene and beyond. I know that they're very interested in the community role of the arts in our health and well-being, whether it actually is our actual health or just our community life. I know they're committed to that, and I think that this person, whoever he or she is, will have to take that all into consideration.
All right. Well, I'm very interested to see that because everybody really did think that he was just sort of blowing smoke, frankly, just to get elected.
What she said about Joyce, though, Joyce was really a part of his campaign, and I know Joyce very well. She's a longtime arts publicist in the city, and she was very key to his campaign, and I think we've all kind of thought that was a pretty good sign from the beginning.
Yeah, well, we'll see. While you're speaking over there, Alicia Anstead, let's talk about these jazz greats. I love these stories of people just popping up in places. Susanna's talked about these young people. Well, these guys are not so young, but they are seasoned, as we say, and they're showing up in a place I never heard of before. Talk about under the radar.
Sure. So this came to me through secondhand through Lee Mergner, who is the editor, the publisher of Jazz Times, as well as our magazine, The Writer, based here in Boston. And Lee told me about Lily Pad, which is a Cambridge performance space and gallery that has music 7 nights a week. And it's jazz, it's indie rock, it's other forms of music. But the one that Lee told me about is this regular Monday night gig that features George Garzon as well as Jerry Berganzi, both of whom are some of the greatest sax players of their generation. And they're also renowned jazz educators in the area. Garzon is at Berkeley. Berganzi is at NEC, the New England Conservatory, and they get together with their groups on Monday nights and do these 8:30 and 10 o'clock shows just about every Monday night in this place that seats about 60 people, but the capacity is just over 90 people. You can buy beer, a glass of wine, and sit there and on a bench and listen to these, you know, seriously great musicians play. I mean, Jazz Times called Berganzi one of America's premier living tenor saxophonists. You can just pop over there for a fairly small amount of money and sit down and watch him and basically reach out and touch, you know, which you're not going to do. But it's extraordinary that this small venue, hole in the wall, very much like the fringe theaters, back alley mentality of we're just going to do this.
Well, I like the whole, you know, sort of jamming in a little space thing. I mean, you know, I confess to being the Scullers and Regatta Bar on the Radar Girl. So, but, you know, I would give this a shot because I love jazz and bring my own pillow. Susanna, you wanted to what?
Well, no, just the lily pad in general, extending beyond Monday nights. It's a great place for, you know, not just the veterans of the jazz world, but some really great smaller musicians. I know that Hasselfest, which is a, you know, local group of musicians who they put on a festival every year, but they do Hassel Nights, which is just, you know, showcasing some of their musicians. But pretty much every night of the week, there is something worth seeing there. And it's a great space. If you want to call it fringe, then definitely. But young people are doing cool things there.
Oh, I love. Well, you know,
and not so young.
And yeah, not so young. And see, from I'm a big jazz proponent. So anytime you have a scenario where I'm sure a lot of people who fall in on Monday and Tuesday they just like music, and they get a chance to hear these guys who are really representing a genre of American music that I want to see preserved and held and appreciated in a way that it's played at it's at a top level, you know. And also, one of them is involved in a group with John Lockwood, and never a finer musician was there. So I'm just really impressed by that. So this is good. I want to, Alicia, just give you, because of the work that you're doing with the writer and have all of us talk about this, and this is just so interesting, how Twitter is sort of taking over the literary world, if you will. I mean, your magazine is focusing on writers who are doing kind of long-form prose stuff. But here's Teju Cole, a Nigerian writer who's getting a lot of attention. If people haven't heard his name, he's the one who's authored Every Day is for the Thief. And I don't think you can turn around without hearing some kind of comment about that piece of work, which, by the way, was written in 2007, which is amazing now he's coming to the fore. But anyway, but you wanted to talk about what he did on Twitter.
Right. And we should say that Every Day is for the Thief was written earlier and published in Nigeria and has just been published in the U.S. So that's the difference there. So Teju Cole is a hybridist. It's very, very hard to nail down just exactly what all of his hyphens would be if you tried to do that. He's an arts critic. He teaches art history at Bard as well as creative writing. But what he did on Twitter was he recently posted in 250 tweets or about 4,000 words an essay about immigration. And the way that he did this was so clever. He posted, of course, in 140 or fewer characters in each tweet. And then for the actual quotations, he opened Twitter accounts for each of the actual people. These are not characters. This is an essay. He opened a Twitter account for each of their names under @POTW because the thing itself is called the Piece of the Wall. So @POTW_ when he was talking, it was _Teju. When one of the real life characters were talking, it was @POTW_Bernie or _Aurora. And that's how he brought their voices into this Twitter feed. It's beautifully rendered. It's lyrical. And like so much of his work has this almost sorrowful beauty to it in the way he uses language. He posted a tweet yesterday that I thought was so gorgeous. Speaking of sorrowful, all it said was, "Oh, sorrow, oh, sorrow, 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 #Iraq. I mean, how touching is that? So I think Twitter is a place where people are experimenting. I don't think it's the new thing anymore. I think that people are finding ways to use it, and he's leading the charge on that. I think there's no reason to believe that Twitter is a frivolous place. It can be, just like an article in the New York Times can be frivolous, or it can be serious. I think Twitter is all those things, and Teju Cole is making it more.
Well, I certainly, and I think you probably, Joel, you and Susanna have heard of other people writing whole pieces on Twitter, but this is the first time I've heard this technique.
There's a literary magazine, Creative Nonfiction. Editor is Lee Gutkind, and they have a platform where you hashtag, I think it's like CNF fiction or CNF tweet, and it's under 140 characters because you have to have that hashtag in there of a little mini story, and you just tweet them out, and it's a lot of, you know, highly recognized authors and just people trying to break in, and they get the best 6 or 10, I think, get published in their quarterly magazine, quarterly book. And it's just like another way for writers to get their brains going and like try to make something beautiful and creative and, you know, relevant in 130 characters. And honestly, like, if, you know, your tweet gets noticed, it might, you know, the next thing that might get noticed is your essay. It's a lot of people trying to break through in these literary magazines and markets, and it's near impossible. And Twitter's, you know, accessible to everybody. So,
well, I also think it's a disciplinary tool that's just, you know, mind-blowing, Joel, if you think about it that way. You know, my editor, of my boss, of my commentaries, can always find the extra words. So maybe if I did enough tweets, I could get the extra words out before I give it to him.
Take out those that's.
You know, it just drives me crazy. What do you think about that?
Well, I think most of us here sort of enjoy that performative aspect of Twitter, kind of the daily life sort of stuff. I'm a little skeptical that it's ever going to be that much of an outlet for creative work. I mean, I just don't think that's the nature of the medium. On the other hand, where distribution is the really important thing, what we were talking about before the summit that arose into that diversity argument, the reason that became such a national discussion throughout the whole theater world was that 3 or 4 of the women who were sitting in the audience at that started live tweeting it. And their friends read those live tweets and retweeted them, and pretty soon everybody in theater in America knew what had been said that night, probably before the meeting was over. And a woman here in Boston, Alana Brownstein, who works at Company One and some of the other places in town, she took them and made this Storify, which is a way of sort of preserving a collection of tweets on one topic, and put it out there on the web so that everybody could come later and read it without clicking through endlessly individual tweets. And that really had a big effect. So as a medium, it's very interesting. I'm not sure how much it's going to be used as an artistic medium.
I don't know. I think, Joel, that for the people for whom it is an artistic medium, it is. And for others, it's not. It's just like maybe some people don't like to read fiction, and so they read other things.
Or poetry.
Yeah, you know, I think it's creative for the people it's creative for, and whether or not it has the same staying power as The Seagull or other works like that, I'm not prepared to make a statement on that. And just, I want to make one quick correction. Cole teaches literature, not creative writing, at Bard.
Okay, very good. All right, so I have the three of you wise arts folks. So I have to get your take on the Thoroughly Modern Millie controversy at Newton North. The play was done by the Newton North students. It was a student production. And they wrestled with how to deal with the stereotypes of the Asian Americans in the original play, changed the Asian Americans to Southern people. By the way, I'm Southern, so that isn't working for me. But in any case, it's just been a lot of discussion about whether or not these plays or pieces, just not plays, but in this case, plays and musicals set in a certain time that are rife with stereotypical portrayals should be produced, or how should that be handled? Let's, Susanna, start with you.
The way that I look at it, and it may not be the right way to look at it because I'm jumping platforms here from theater to film, is that no one would remake a movie and keep all of these offensive elements to it. In theater, we have the option to remake plays more frequently, and we aren't always rewriting them. But that's, you know, theater purists, and there's also some nostalgia from these musicals. You're not going to rewrite lyrics. But we also have the option to pick which plays we want to choose. And, you know, the companies who are choosing these plays who are going to offend or disgust or, you know, enrage an audience, you know, that's not good for them and that's not good for the community. I'm thinking most recently of the production of Company by Moonbox Productions at Calderwood Pavilion. And, you know, it's a very popular musical, but the outdated roles of, you know, gender, and there's some, you know, very racist lines in there. They chose to put it on even while Stephen Sondheim is working on rewrites to try to make it more updated. They're incorporating a gay protagonist versus a, you know, this bachelor who's just totally outdated. And, you know, I'm sitting there in the theater and I can't help but look at it from my 21st century perspective. I can't transport myself to this 1960s mentality, 1970s mentality of, you know, what Sondheim was seeing at that time. That being said, theater purists, they have every right to put on whatever they want to put on. No one's going to censor art, but we are allowed to react as theater goers and critics in whatever way we choose to. You know, but that doesn't mean that we're not going to continue to revisit Chekhov and Shakespeare and, you know, Beckett, anyone. It's just a matter of picking and choosing which ones and, you know, considering reviving it in a way that somehow makes it culturally relevant. I think that yellow face and black face, putting it out on stage, I mean, they did put yellow face on stage, you know, that,
right.
then
yes.
that was a very poor choice. And I mean, there should be scolding from that. But we have, not everyone's going to look at these productions in the same way that they pick up an old movie or an old novel. We sit down with an old novel and we see these stereotypes and these caricatures. But we're able to somehow, because we have this book, because we know it's written in 1920s, we're able to take that away. In theater, it's live production. It's the part is the audience participation. It's like this very like live moment. We can't kind of take ourselves back and be like, oh, well, actually, let me remind myself this was written 100 years ago.
Okay. Susanna, so now there's a slippery slope argument, Joel.
Well, there's a couple of things here. First of all over your listening audience tonight, playwrights are clutching their chests in alarm at the idea that we can just take all these things and rewrite them. Chekhov and Shakespeare are dead. I'm not sure about Thoroughly Modern Millie if it's still in copyright or not, but the theater world takes very seriously the idea of people just sort of willy-nilly changing things to eliminate parts that they personally find offensive.
What about Susanna's point is we have choices, so why make
we
that
have
choice?
Choices, right.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think that's something that has to be considered when you're deciding what play you're going to do. The other thing is that this was... you know, the idea that these stereotypes in this play sort of grappled with the issue of stereotypes or something, you know, are they just there to entertain back in the day when that was considered funny, or are they really dealing with this issue? I'm writing about for this week a play called, I believe it's The Unbleached American, that's coming up at Stoneham, about an African-American singer-performer right around 1900 who sort of pioneered entertaining white folks with very, very racist songs and became rather wealthy doing it. And he's at the end of his life in this play, and he's sort of grappling with what he's done. So it's a very complicated thing. And then you throw in the fact that these were high school kids
right.
doing the production.
And
that 17% just adds another layer.
The student population is Asian American. There were meetings I want to put on the table with some of the Asian American parents and kids. And as one woman was quoted saying, you know, from her blog, an Asian American parent, nobody, you know, this everybody thinks it's okay to do. To, you know, yellow face or to make fun of Asians, and they wouldn't think of doing it with black folks or Latino folks. Yeah, they would, but I get her point very much. Yes, Alicia.
That was actually the heartbreaking part for me, was that young Asian American high schooler who couldn't participate in his passion, theater, because there was no place for him or any place that he wanted to be in this play. You know, I think that works like Thoroughly Modern Millie. I don't know why anybody would gravitate toward that one anyway, but if you're going to do it, if you can't take an innovative approach to it, then I don't really see why you would bring that one back. You know, when Arthur Lawrence put on West Side Story in recent times again, he worked to, and when Stephen Sondheim as well, worked on updating that. Stephen Sondheim has said how much he was... not ashamed of the language he used in the lyrics of West Side Story, but that it was a weak point for him, and he had the opportunity to change that. I think living playwrights are out there, and you can ask them, could we work together on this? We're struggling, and all those ones who are cringing.
And people do.
And they do. Mm. They really do. I mean, art is fluid. It's a very messy thing. It's unsettled and wild in its best form. And, you know, we can work on these things to change them or to leave them behind. I'm not an advocate of letting go of all the classics, but I am an advocate for innovation. And we see that in these adaptations that we were talking about earlier. How do you twist it into something that makes a commentary on it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The irony here is that those school officials probably chose that play because they thought, oh, a musical from the 40s. There can't be anything offensive
right.
in this. This will be easy.
I'm pretty sure my high school did a Thoroughly Modern Millie when I was a senior. And I remember being in theater, like,
Well, you know, my comment would be that I get all the arguments, the slippery slope one, the, you know, how are we changing people's original work? Isn't it art is fluid? Shouldn't we have some respect for the time and try to teach to that? In this instance, if they were going to try to teach to that after having made the decision, you better be teaching the audience because, you know, they did something with the kids. Oh, well, you know, the audience came to your point, Susanna, and they just took it in. And there was nothing there. And, you know, that it's heartbreaking if you're a kid and been in that position. And certainly I have. So I feel very strongly about it. And my point is that when people are saying, well, you just can't please everybody, typically the kind of stereotypes that are in the plays have nothing to do with the majority of people. So I say, you don't understand what I'm talking about. So that's where I'm coming from. You know, and that annoys me to no end. I really do understand the other arguments, but that's, you know, back to the choice thing. There's a bunch of choices out here, and let's try to think about it. And yet I appreciate people wanted to go to your answer. I mean, to you, Alicia, they wanted to do Thoroughly Modern Millie because there's some great songs in Thoroughly Modern Millie. I mean, you know, so there's a lot to put on the table. But I thought having your great brains on this subject was good. And I appreciate your weighing in. To be continued. thank you, Alicia, Joel, and Susanna, for joining me this week.
Thank you,
Callie. Our pleasure.
Alicia Anstead is the editor of Inside Arts Magazine and the Harvard Arts Blog and editor-in-chief of The Writer Magazine. Joel Brown is a contributor for the Boston Globe, writing the Stages column about local theater. His blog is hubarts.com. And Susanna Jackson is the arts and entertainment editor for Dig Boston. Coming up, Lon Yap, our Something Extra segment. Triple Threat Debbie Allen was already a success when one role made her a household name. Fame, the movie and TV series, showcased her extraordinary dancing and acting talent. Who better to select the next generation of talent in Boston? A conversation with Debbie Allen about that and more next. You're listening to Under the Radar. I'm Callie Crossley.